the last 30 years we have been gathering pace.
Yes.
And now we are reaching the tipping point where our place in the world is changing. We are a young nation, yes. We are a poor nation, but we are not just building an economy.
Hmm.
We are rebuilding a civilization. So the problem seems to be non-white billionaires.
That's right.
And India being a potential source of them. Let all kinds of different kinds of things flourish.
Hmm.
Some of it will be rubbish. That's perfectly fine.
Hello and welcome. I am Anupam Kher. Welcome to the show where for the next half an hour, we will be discussing all things India-Bharat with a very special guest. Welcome, Sanjeev Sanyal. Welcome.
Sanjeev Sanyal is a prominent economist who's held a number of high-profile positions over the years. He started out in financial economics in the 90s and was awarded an Eisenhower Fellowship in 2007. In 2010, the World Economic Forum named him a young global leader. Up till February 2022, Sanjeev Sanyal held the post of the principal economic advisor to India's finance ministry. He is now serving as a member of the Economic Advisory Council to Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
Thank you for coming. Explain to me, means I'm asking as an ordinary citizen of this country, what does it mean to be Economic Advisory Council to the Prime Minister of India?
So, as you can imagine, the idea is to look at the big picture about the economy of the country.
Mm.
So I'm not really in the operations part of running the government on a day-to-day basis.
Mm.
A small number of us, so there are only three permanent members.
Mm.
Our job is to look at, say, for example, what are the reforms to be done?
Mm.
Look at the big picture as far as our place in the world, what is happening in the rest of the world and our place in it. What's happening to growth or macroeconomic stability and so on. And to be able to brief the Prime Minister and the Cabinet about what are the kinds of things that we should be doing on the economic front.
Mm.
Now, that is a very general thing.
Mm.
But in reality, what it means is, first of all, remember, at the Prime Minister's level, everything and anything converges.
Mm.
So very often what happens is what I am doing may not be what in a textbook sense is economics.
Mm.
So I may end up looking at sports policy, or I may look at, you know, rationalization of national monuments or something, or, you know, thinking about, how to deal with a geopolitical situation. So the role is in some ways very, very eclectic. And very often, a lot of time that I spend at least is looking at, for example, suggestions and ideas that come from the ministries or people who happen to meet the Prime Minister, and they give suggestions and ideas. Not like Prime Minister Modi was personally sitting and researching all of those suggestions or ideas.
Mm.
He gives it to somebody. I am that somebody. Similarly, I may have an idea for some reason. Mm. Then, you know, I'll make a presentation, say maybe we should look at this or whatever. So I'm part of that, you can call it a think tank, which works for the Prime Minister on basically running the economy.
And it's a very prestigious position to be in, and it's a little precarious also.
Well, it's certainly a privilege, particularly, I mean, it would have been a privilege at any time.
Yeah.
But it is specifically a privilege at this time because we are clearly in one of those turning points of Indian history.
Yes, absolutely.
So we can feel, and anybody living in India can feel that, you know, we are going through something special, that our place in the world is changing after hundreds of years of foreign domination, then bad economic policies from our side. You know, finally, the last 30 years, we have been gathering pace.
Yes.
And now we are reaching the tipping point where our place in the world is changing. I mean, we are already the world's fifth largest economy. Within the next 24 odd months, we'll become the world's third largest economy.
Yeah.
So to have been in the cockpit, in a sense, when this happened, is very special.
This whole development, this whole fifth position and the third position, how does third position happen?
So basically what is happening is that our economy is now growing very fast.
Mm.
It is by some margin the fastest growing major economy in the world.
Mm.
Last year we grew at 8.2%.
Mm.
This year we shall grow by 7% or thereabouts.
Mm.
But the thing that people forget is the compounding effect. So when India began to reform its economy in 1991, you know how big our economy was? Just 260 billion.
Okay.
Okay. Then it took us 16 years to become $1 trillion economy. Okay, so it's only in 2007-08 that we became a $1 trillion economy.
Okay.
16 years. Then it took 7 years to become a $2 trillion economy. Then it should have taken us 5 years. But then we had COVID, etc. So it took another 7 years again. So it's only in 2021, 22, which is not so long ago, that we became a $3 trillion economy.
Okay.
After that, it took us just 3 years to become a $4 trillion economy, which we will become this year.
Okay.
And then we'll take a little more than 2 years to become a $5 trillion economy.
Wow.
And then, so you see, the compound, people underestimate the compounding process. It is the most powerful force in the world.
Yes.
And so as our economic size expands and we keep compounding this, the compound interest rates, everybody learns it in school, but they forget that in the beginning, in the initial bit, it seems slow. But once it reaches a certain pace, it begins to gallop. So even China was the same size as our economy in 1990. So how did it get here? How has it become the world's second largest economy? In fact, by some measures, the world's largest economy. Essentially, they grew a few percentage points faster than us, but kept going for 30 odd years. That's how they got here. So all we have to do now is to keep doing this and compound it.
And what are the most pressing economic reforms and what needs to be done?
Well, I could spend the rest of the day with that. Let me say that there are a huge number of things we need to do. I'll simplify them first of all. First thing we need to do is to keep our economy growing so that investment keeps happening. So from the government side, we need to do physical infrastructure, soft infrastructure, keep investing in that. From the corporate side, we need to do ease of doing business so that the private sector and foreign investors come and invest in factories and back office operations, etc. in India. So that creates the momentum in the economy, creates the jobs and all of that. So that is one part of what we need to do. The second part of what we need to do is that while we are doing this, we have to keep the system stable. We can't allow our banks to blow up or, you know, inflation to spike up and so on. So that's a very second important thing we need to do. The third important thing we need to do is to make sure that the very poorest people in the country get some direct support. Because while most of the boats will rise because of the rising tide, there are some people who will not. So for them, you have to do direct benefits transfer, Pradhan Mantri Awas Yojana, and help them build houses or give them some way of getting gas, or at least they move away from burning wood or Nal Se Jal, whatever it may be. Basically direct. So these are the three principles. And the last one, you know, the word we use for it is Antudai. These are the three. Now, in order to do this, you need to do a whole bunch of things. So I would argue that one of the single most important things, we need to do is to reform our judicial system. Why? Because with some 50 million cases stuck in our judicial system, we are not being able to enforce contracts on time. This is a major issue for our business sector. We are not able to give justice on time to the average citizen. So I think this is one big area of reform we need to do in the next round.
How will that happen?
Well, obviously, a lot of it will have to be done by the judiciary. But the government will also have to participate. And the second important thing we need to do is to finally begin to reform our administration. You see, since 1991 till now, what have we done? We have basically withdrawn the bureaucracy's power to do damage. We have not reformed the bureaucracy. We have simply restrained it back. Because before 1991, they were pretty much allowed to do whatever they wanted. Now we have restrained them. But we didn't reform them. But now we need to actually reform them so that the civil service can actually become service-oriented and actually do the things they're supposed to do, like fix the roads, do municipal services, and et cetera, et cetera. But that reorientation has to happen. Because even today, the bureaucracy is essentially designed to control the population. That is what the colonial era was. But oddly enough, that is also what the socialist era was. Yeah, it's about controlling the population. We need to move our civil service away from that mindset of control to a mindset of service delivery. And that is, again, one major reform that we need to do. So there are two big reforms. Both of them involve getting the Indian state to do the things it's supposed to do. All this while, 30 years, we were trying to stop it from doing the things it did not or should not be doing, like running airlines. But now we need to get it to do the things it's supposed to do. And we have begun to do some of it, to be fair. I mean, for example, this huge infrastructure build-out is being done by the state. We are making progress, but, you know, this is something we need to focus on.
How do you deal with roadblocks?
So first of the important thing is that you have to understand that we are not just building an economy. We are rebuilding a civilization, which has effectively been in decline for centuries.
Yes.
So we are literally building back the whole thing. So many people ask me, you know, why do I take such a big interest in, for example, history and culture and these kinds of things, or urban design and so on? Because if I had only a purely economic view, I wouldn't care about those things. Now, the economy is an important part of rebuilding civilization, but it's not the only thing. You have to rebuild the whole thing. And in this sense, I would argue that we are trying to trigger something akin to what the Europeans went through in the 15th, 16th century, which is a renaissance, a rebirth. So when you go to Europe and you see, you say you go to Florence and you see those beautiful churches, you go to Venice and or you go, you know, see buildings from Elizabethan England. The idea is that you are seeing the cultural artifacts, but the cultural artifacts are only one part of what happened. Florence was a center for banking. Their true contribution to human civilization is actually double entry bookkeeping. Similarly, Venice's true contribution to the world is actually the stock market. Now, because they were generating all this wealth from all these commercial activities, they built all these fancy buildings and those paintings, Leonardo, Da Vinci, etc. At about the same time, you had Galileo coming up, all these scientific changes. So what happens in a renaissance is that you have massive risk-taking happening at different fields at the same time. So that's at roughly the same time that Shakespeare is performing at the Globe, you also have Francis Drake circumnavigating the Earth, or the English defeating the Armada. It's a state of mind of risk-taking, and it happens simultaneously on all fields. So what, in the end, we are trying to do is to create a culture of risk-taking in this country. For far too long, we were afraid of the rest of the world. Even after becoming independent.
We were made to feel that.
Yes, and even after becoming independent, we continue to have this thing in our head. No, no, we can't compete with the rest of the world, so let us close ourselves into some import substitution thing. That was our mindset. Now we have a different mindset, that we can go out there and conquer markets. We can compete with the best in the world. We can send something to the moon. And you can see that filter through to every aspect of life. But that ability and willingness to go out there and convert, you know, a defeat into a victory is something that has clicked in our head in relatively recent times.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you.
Whereas if you go back and look at all our history, it's full of wars and battles where we almost won and then got defeated. So this switch is something that has changed in us. And it is not done yet. It's not got, I wouldn't say it's yet institutionalized, but definitely this change has happened.
Thought has happened.
Yes. And you can feel it. If you live in India, you can feel it.
Wow, that's amazing. So this, the success of Make in India program is very evident. Is there any failure or setbacks that are happening?
The most important thing to understand is that if there are no failures happening all the time, that means there are no successes happening.
That's okay? Right.
Successes happen only when people are taking the risk of failure. So I actually see continuous bankruptcy and insolvency, etc., as a good thing. I believe that at every point in time, some company should be going bankrupt because it means that the system as a whole is taking more risk. Earlier on, what we used to do, if a company went for whatever reason, and from time to time, companies will face problems, whether it's public sector or private sector. Our thinking was, let's put them in a warehouse and we will use large amount of taxpayers' money to keep it somehow going. Today, what we will do, we'll put it in the NCLT and bankrupt it, sell off its assets and carry on. And we have discovered it doesn't cause any great disruption to the system. All that happens, those assets get redeployed and a healthy new company comes. Even the height of COVID, one of our largest airlines, Jet Airways, went bankrupt. And we said, okay, you went bankrupt, bankrupt. So it requires a certain attitude towards risk taking. Now, it is also important at the same time that we do not see those who go bankrupt as somehow bad or evil or something. They took a risk. They went bankrupt. I think once you've gone through your bankruptcy process and, you know, been cleaned up, you should be allowed to go back and take another risk. Because that's how the system generates new ideas, new ventures. So, but this is an attitude. And this happens not just, I am obviously talking about in the space of business. But this is not the only space. This should happen in the sciences. This should happen in the arts. Let all kinds of different kinds of things flourish. Some of it will be rubbish. That's perfectly fine.
So how is it important? How much is it important for us to say that, okay, West is recognizing our growth? Does it matter to us?
Well, it's some...
Because I keep reading...
Well, it sort of matters, but I think we shouldn't get too worked up about Western validation beyond a point.
Partly, does it make you angry?
No, of course. They're cynically trying to manipulate us. I mean, that is true. Of course, it is annoying because at the end of it, do remember that when China was rising, the same fellow said that, no, the numbers were all wrong. They were lying, this, that, till China became too big to ignore. They were the same people who were saying, no, Singapore is not progressing. It's autocratic, all kinds of things. So my view on all of this is, in some ways, getting criticized is a rite of passage. We of the emerging world have to pass through, in a sense, because during that passage, we ourselves discover that actually the opinions of all these people doesn't matter. They're just making it up. And in fact, what they're really losing is being able to, you know, patronizingly tell us, "Tum city of joy ho," and something like that. All those kinds of things that they wanted to do. After all, what they love to do is to be, you know, the BBC India hand sitting in India
even
and
in movies,
passing judgments on us.
They celebrate our poverty rather than the richness
Absolutely.
Of our...
So the moment we begin to do well, they'll say billionaire Raj or this thing. But the fact of the matter is they celebrate their own billionaires. After all these people who are, all these NGOs who come and lecture us about problems in India are all funded by Rockefeller Foundation, Ford Foundation, Gates Foundation, Soros's Open Society, Omerdiyar Foundation. Now, who are all these people? They're all billionaires. So, Gora billionaire, tali bajao. So the problem seems to be non-white billionaires.
That's right.
And India being a potential source of them. Right. And I keep telling people, you know, Thomas Piketty is not coming here and generating jobs for us. It's going to be those same Ambani, Adani, Tata, Birla, all of whom you mock.
Yeah.
And yes, they should pay their taxes. They should follow their rules. So I have, you know, I have no love lost for the rich if they're not following the rules. They have to follow them. But, you know, the fact is that we need, rather than criticize this lot, we should add to them.
Correct.
We are 1/6 of the world's population. We have a right to 1/6 of the world's billionaires.
I love that. How close are we to Atmanirbhar Bharat, self-sufficient Bharat?
Atmanirbhar means that we have the financial resources to take our place in the world, to be able to stand up for our interests in the world. And we have demonstrably showed in the last few years that we are willing to do that. You see that in foreign policy. You see that in our ability to generate our own technologies. We can see, for example, we have inserted ourselves into the global supply chains for mobile phones. We are now the second or third largest mobile phone manufacturer in the world, whereas just 4 or 5 years ago, we weren't even in the picture. So we are quite capable of being Atmanirbhar, but we should be very careful not to interpret Atmanirbhar as some sort of a closed, autarkic kind of a mindset of isolation. We are Atmanirbhar in the sense of being able to stand up and take our place in the world.
And also, I think we often hear India as well as Russia and China still referred to as emerging economies. How fair is this classification?
Well, it is it's a bit of a condescending classification. It may have had sense in the second half of the 20th century in the way we thought about the world. And sometimes it's useful as a shorthand for talking about the global, what we now call the global south or whatever you may want to call it. But yes, I mean, right now the world is a messier place. In terms of, while the per capita income of China, for example, is still much lower than that of major Western country, the fact is in sheer scale and industrial capacity, and even in areas, many areas of technology, China is at the cutting edge. So it is not an emerging, it is very much emerged in many, many areas.
Exactly.
We ourselves are still emerging. We are, of course, poor. I mean, the size of our economy shouldn't fool us, because at the end of it, we will, even after all this growth, we will be in a few years' time the world's third largest economy. Mm. We are the world's largest population already. Mm. So when you divide one by the other...
And we are also a young nation. We are a young nation.
Yeah. We are a poor nation. Uh-huh. So I think it's fair to say that we are still an emerging country. But I think what is different about this generation is that we have stopped thinking of it as some sort of a static condition. Mm. We are a charity case whose only future is, you know, NGOs from abroad will come and give us some help. Mm. And, you know, every winter, NRI economists from the US will come and lecture us at India Habitat Center about how to improve our lives. Mm. That we have gone past that.
Yeah. And how do you deal with the criticism from within the country?
That is fair. Mm. Those who live here have an opinion. We should listen to it. Mm. They have a vote as well. And so I think there is a feedback loop. In fact, we should take criticism even from abroad. But I always take criticism much more seriously from people who have a stake in the system directly, in the sense that if there is no skin in the game, everybody can give you advice. And I have experienced it myself. For example, during the COVID crisis, everybody in the world had an idea about how India should run its economy. Mm. And there were Nobel laureates like Stiglitz and Krugman and all, who had all kinds of views of how India should run their economy. Mm. We didn't listen to any of their lectures. We ran our economy, and it's not something I'm telling you ex post. Mm. Even at that time, I went on television, I wrote articles and clearly stated, we are not going to go out there and blow up our debt or our monetary system because of your fanciful ideas. Mm. And the net result of it is that we have, you know, a most macroeconomically stable country right now. Mm. Whereas look at what has happened to Western economies. I mean, the US, for example, has a real tough situation. Their fiscal is out of control. They're trying to balance it with their monetary side, which is a bad way of doing it. And it's causing stresses, not just to them, it's causing stresses to the rest of the world. Mm. The UK economy is in a tough situation. The European economy is in a tough place. All of which, because of ridiculous policies that they were following, which at that time, we warned them about. It's not that at that time we weren't telling them. I was at that time the chair of the framework working group of the G20. Mm. And I used to meet their top people and I warned them exactly what would happen with their policies. Mm. And exactly that happened.
A person like you, who is so passionate and so has this amazing clarity, has I'm using the word boss as Mr. Modi, who is a great listener and who also has an amazing passion for our country.
He's not somebody to suffer fools, as you know.
Yes.
And so you have to have done your homework, done the maths.
It has made a difference because a person like him is at the helm of the thing.
Absolutely. I mean, look, when the whole world tells you to do something and you are doing something else,
right,
or advising him to do something else,
right,
then... it requires a certain level of courage to be able to push in that way.
How do you relax with this kind of pressure, or you don't feel the pressure?
Well, anybody who knows me, that I am always buzzed up. Mm. So I can't say I relax, but I do things which are away from work.
Yeah.
Obviously, one of the passions is looking at history and things like that. So I go to a lot of archaeological sites and things like that. And I play a lot of sports.
Like which?
Well, till relatively recently, I used to be, doing taekwondo and play squash. And,
yes. I believe you come from a family of, I'll not say fighters, but your son is a mixed martial art.
Yes, my elder son, Varun, is a national, in fact, international level mixed martial arts fighter.
And Dhruv,
my younger son also does martial arts, although hasn't chosen it as a profession yet. Anyway,
yeah.
So yes, I like adrenaline based sports. When I was in college, for example, I used to do paragliding. In fact, I have one of India's first paragliding licenses. So I was part of the first batch of four who got their paragliding license. So I can claim to have pioneered that sport in
India.
Oh,
wonderful.
I also used to be, and I'm no longer have the fitness for it, professional level whitewater kayaking and canoeing person. So I had an instructor grade certification in kayaking and canoeing. So going down rough rivers and things. So you can imagine my general attitude is I like a little bit of risk, whatever I'm doing.
Yes.
If you can't get badly hurt in doing whatever you're doing, I lose interest in the matter quite quickly.
Right.
So I unfortunately reached a point in my life where my joints can't take the pounding anymore. So I have to do more staid things like go to the gym.
What do you do? You go to the gym.
I do go to the gym, and I still play some sports. I occasionally play squash and so on. But as I said, it is the mind is willing, but the body, at least the joints are increasingly less willing.
Thank you. Thank you, Sanjeev Sanyal. It has been a pleasure talking to you. And thank you for watching. Join me next week for another intimate conversation with another esteemed guest. And let's talk Bharat.